Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the host and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have problems with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 321 of Registry Matters. Good evening, Larry. How are you?
I'm doing awesome, except it's a little bit cool out here.
Oh, is it? Okay, I was just going to ask you. You said it was like 28 below zero. But don't you have like 50 degree temperature swings in your part of the woods?
Yeah, it was 24, 25 overnight, and it went up to 50.
That's only 25. I remember like Vegas will be freaking freezing, and then you're sweating. I'm not going to say the word, but it's like you would play tennis with these things, hot as... You can fill in the blank. And it would have like a 50 degree temperature swing. So it'd be 30 in the morning and 70-ish, 80-ish in the afternoon. It's insane.
I do remember that.
Well, please, if you would be so very kind, press like, subscribe, share it with people. Go over on the subreddit. There's 11,000 people over on the subreddit and tell them how great a program it was. I don't really like doing it me personally because I feel that's very like braggadocious, I guess would be a word. So anywho. Go over there and send your love and all that. And then if you're feeling extra generous, go over to Patreon and show your support there. But what are we doing on this episode, Larry?
Chance is not able to be with us, so it's just Mr. Gloom and Doom again for this episode.
That's you. You are Mr. Doom and Gloom.
So we have a case from the West Virginia Supreme Court that did not go well for us. We have an article that we kicked down the road that says that we should end the PFR registry. And I think the origination is from Georgia. And we can briefly discuss the PFR case I'm working on here in New Mexico that involves an 87-year-old man who has dementia. And I'm trying to dodge it, but you probably want to discuss the recent election results and what it means for PFRs.
Nope, not going to do it. We've already decided that that's off limits. We are not going to discuss... the recent election. I should have actually asked you, which election? Which election would that be, Larry?
That would be for the mayor of Albuquerque.
Okay. Yes, that is going to impact the nation of PFRs. I got it. Well, do me a favor, though. So let's kick this off. And tell me about the 87-year-old geezer. Like, this is one of your contemporaries.
Well, I'm older than he is, but he has dementia, and we talked about it. I think on the last episode, or the episode before, whichever it was, but he has dementia. And he cannot keep things straight in his head. And he's been charged with multiple times for failing to comply. And all those cases were consolidated and dismissed because of his incompetency. Mentally, he's not able to understand the nature of the proceedings. Well, they filed a brand new case against him, so he had to deal with a warrant. So we're back at work again. And I told a state representative, I said, just lean on the sheriff to dismiss the case, or make the case go away. The man can never be successfully prosecuted. And he's agreed. He went and registered. He's back into compliance. He posted his bond, his $50 bond for failing to register. And they won't dismiss the case. So now... he was in court yesterday, and the judge ordered a new competency exam, and he has to be sent to Las Vegas again to be reevaluated again at 87 years old with dementia so that we can waste judicial resources, and the detective will have to show up again to testify against him if this case goes forward to result in no conviction because he can't be convicted. And these are the people who claim that they do not have enough resources, that they would love to be able to provide citizens protection. And I leaned on the representative. I said, call the sheriff out on this. Say these things. And the representative was like, I can't say that. I said, why can't you? Tell me what dreadful thing would happen. And she says, well, I just can't. We just don't talk to one another like that. I said, well, I think it's time we start. You need to tell him, look, when you come with your handout for additional resources and telling us how short-staffed you are, I'm going to remind you of this in committee hearing that you're pursuing an 87-year-old demented man who you can never convict. I might just do that, but she's not going to do it. But can you at least admit that this is funny, that he has to go through this all over again?
Definitely not. Can you go back to something? You said something, he has to go to Vegas, like, so they would transport him. How far is Vegas from you?
Well, it's our Las Vegas, New Mexico. It's where the state hospital
is. Oh! I was like, why would they send him to Nevada?
No, yeah, it's where our state forensic center is in Las Vegas.
Well, how far is that, though?
It's a far little piece, but it's the expense of it. He has to go back.
Of course.
And they'll have to sequence him in for an eval. He's an outpatient. And they'll have to, I mean, he's out of custody, I should say. They'll have to sequence him in for when they can do the evaluation. And he'll have to be examined. And then the reports will have to be drafted, sent to the court. Everybody will get the same report. It'll be very similar to the previous report. And they'll be faced with the same decision again. Do you want to try to commit this man to the state hospital? Because you cannot commit him to prison. If he's incompetent, he can't be tried until his competence is restored. And you can't restore dementia. As far as I know, it can't be restored. So we're just spinning our wheels with this guy.
And would you venture any sort of guess at the cost of doing these, sending him out there, whatever? Like, does he get transported like in a police car, or does, is he required? Like, he's 87 in dementia. He's not, probably not driving on his own.
I don't know how he'll get there, but as an outpatient, normally they transport themselves, and he'll go to the hospital when they can provide him an arrival date. But this whole process is going to cost many thousands of dollars, because right. The state hospital staff has to spend time doing their workup. Then the judicial resources of the court have to review it. The defense attorney, the PD's office, has to review it. Then they have to convene, decide whether they're going to stipulate that he's not dangerous. And if I'm the state, if he hadn't registered, I'd have said, well, I'm not going to keep stipulating him not being dangerous, which generates a new procedure to see if he can be committed against his will. But he has registered, so they might stipulate again that he's not dangerous. But the sheriff needs to stop bringing the cases, because there's nothing you can do to this old guy. Let go of it. Admit defeat. Let go of it. Let's move on, just like the election. We lost the election. Let's move on.
I didn't want to bring this up. I understand it's your mayoral election. Okay, so fine. But, and then you also said it's a $50 failure to register fee?
No, his bond was $50.
Bond, okay. And I assume, as in most states, if you actually get convicted of this, like in Georgia, it's a year minimum. Is it similar?
No, it's a 18-month maximum here.
God. Georgia, first time is a year, second is 5, and third is 30 for failure to register.
The minimum here, there is no minimum. It is a maximum of 18 with 50% good time, because it's a nonviolent offense. And so it's a 9 months effective maximum, and it never gets imposed on a first-time offender, because it's a civil regulatory scheme. So they never impose anything other than probation. If they could convict him at 87, he would only get probation.
Actually, you know, I was thinking about it over. I'm changing subjects pretty hard. We can move on, but I was thinking about the shirts that we have at the little I can't remember the name of the spread shop. I think is the URL if you wanted to go buy merch. I was going to make, like, we should make shirts. It's like, it's a civil regulatory scheme. It's not punishment. Something like that on a shirt.
Sure. I'd like to.
People could wear that, actually, and not, and it would create some kind of conversation. But at least you're not running around with something that says, like, PFR or something like that. So people could actually wear it.
Absolutely. Well, unlike my kind friends on the conservative side, I actually call my team out. We supposedly have a progressive sheriff named John Allen. He ran on a platform of being different and using resources wisely. I don't hesitate to say, John Allen, you're not keeping your word, sir. I'm disappointed in you, sir. I wish you were being the progressive that you ran on, sir. And I'd like for you to take that into consideration, sir. But I can't get my conservative friends to call their people out when they disappoint them. I have no hesitation to call my team out when they're disappointed. I just did.
Let's head over to the fine state of West Virginia. And I think that's, I guess, North and South Dakota split. But there was something significant about West Virginia being carved out of Virginia. And I don't remember what it exactly is. Do you know?
That was actually a few years before I was born, so I'm not sure all the nuances of that.
Something significant and something constitutionally, like you can't split states, but that one did. I don't remember. There's something about that one, and I don't remember. Anywho. We don't really ever get anything that often from this state, but you did find one from the West Virginia Supreme Court. So this must be good.
It's good for sure, and it's definitely funny.
I'm certain that it's gonna not be funny. And what's this all about? So before you answer that, I need you to know that I've read it myself. It's about a PFR that moved from state to state.
Well, that is in fact true, but what else?
All right, well, the name of the case is the State of West Virginia versus the Honorable Paul W. Gwaltney, Jr., Judge of the Circuit Court of Monongahela County, and William J. McGoog. And I can tell you he's in big trouble for failure to comply with his registration. How did I do on that summary?
That's also true, but do you mind setting up just a little bit more?
But before I do that, I notice that the case is against a judge. That seems unusual.
It is indeed. It's a petition for a writ of prohibition.
I'm sorry, could you say that again?
It's a petition for a writ of prohibition.
Is this anything to do with alcohol?
Not that kind of prohibition.
I see. All right. Well, so tell me what that is. I vaguely remember that you recommended such a course of action years ago against a judge in Georgia. And God, you know what? I'm going to tell you. Can I tell you the name of the judge?
Sure.
Nunn. N-U-N-N.
Now, that's funny.
How about that? I got memory like you.
Is that right?
Yes.
So, well, it's... did you ask me a question? It's an extraordinary writ, is what it is. One of the list of seldom used writs, and it's used to prohibit a judge from exceeding his or her authority.
All right. Well, I see. So in May of 22, so here's a little bit of background. In May of 2022, a grand jury returned an indictment against respondent William McGoog. God, I hate that. It's McGoogh. I hope that it could be Gaug. Goog? What do you think that is?
I think it's McGow.
Okay, it could be McGow. I'll go with McGow. That sounds a little more fluid. So against respondent William McGow, charging him with two counts of a second or subsequent failure to register or provide notice of registration changes in violation of West Virginia Code, subsection 15-12-8, subsection C, paragraph 2. I think I nailed that, Larry.
You did.
Wow. According to the indictment, respondent McGoo moved to West Virginia on May 7th of 2021, sorry, and then was required by law to register for how long, Larry? For life. God, in your case, man, that would be forever. At least the rest of us, we only have to register for like 60 or 70 years. You're like pushing triple digits if it's your case.
Absolutely.
Then to continue, unlawfully, feloniously, and knowingly failed to register, and then finally had previously been convicted of a felony failure to register or provide notice of registration change on or about May 13th of 2015 in the District Court of Maryland for Frederick County. That's a lot of information. How did I do?
That's fantastic, and I don't think you really need me.
Hold on, you need to pipe down over there. Stop complaining, and we'll keep going. What legal maneuvers did McGow take that moved the case to the state Supreme Court?
Well, he filed a motion to dismiss the indictment that the grand jury returned against him. And the circuit court, which would be the trial court, granted the pretrial motion to dismiss the indictment, concluding that, quote, the facts of the current case did not support a finding that respondent McGow was required to register in West Virginia.
I'm assuming that the state did not agree with the circuit court's decision?
That would be an understatement. Oh, what's funny is that the controlling precedent has only been in place since May of 2024, and the precedential case occurred as a result of actions taken by this same judge. They stated that the court has held a circuit court may not grant a defendant's pretrial motion to dismiss an indictment on the basis of the sufficiency of the evidence of whether a factual basis for the indictment exists. And they cited State versus Gwaltney, and that was decided in May of 2024. I won't give the citation number, but that is kind of ironic, isn't it?
I believe so, yeah. So respondent McGow claimed that he was no longer required to register as a PFR in Ohio, the original jurisdiction where he was originally convicted. Now, tell me, what do you think made him think that?
Well, he did what a lot of PFRs do. He did his own research, and he concluded that for himself. McGill stated that upon moving to West Virginia, he, quote, checked the appropriate corresponding statute and understood it to read as him not being required to register in West Virginia as the state where his original charge originated. Ohio had since lifted the requirement, and too many PFRs mistakenly believe that if they've had the requirement lifted in one state, and you're just wrong about that. And so was McGill.
Now, according to McGill, the appropriate corresponding statute in West Virginia code, something similar to what I said before, which is contained in the PFR Registration Act, West Virginia code 15-12-9, subsection C, provides any person changing residence to this state from another state or federal or military jurisdiction who is required to register under the laws of that state or federal military jurisdiction shall register in this state. McGill argued that this statute is ambiguous, that the rule of lenity therefore applies, and that the statute must be construed against the state. Is that ambiguous?
Well, not to me, it isn't.
But wait, hold on, stop. It says if he's required to register, and if they stop making him register in Ohio, then he wouldn't have to register in West Virginia.
Well, but that's not the totality of the statutory scheme.
Oh, there's more to it. All right, well then, can you please explain the rule of lenity? Can you explain what that word means to begin with?
It's one of those Latin words, and it's a judicial doctrine that dictates that any ambiguity in statutes must be resolved in favor of the accused. Basically, it means a tie goes to the runner. If you look at footnote 4, the court stated, this court has held that in construing an ambiguous criminal statute, the rule of lenity applies, which requires that penal statutes be strictly construed against the state and in favor of the defendant. And that's on page 4 of the opinion.
And I'm going to ask you again, is the statute ambiguous?
No, it is not. In fact, the language is quite clear. West Virginia Code 15-12-2, subsection B, provides any person who has been convicted of an offense or an attempted offense or has been found not guilty by reason of mental illness, mental retardation, or addiction of an offense under any of the following provisions or the codes under statutory provision of another state, the United States Code, or the Uniform Code of Military Justice, which requires proof of the same essential elements, shall register as set forth in this statute of the code and according to the internal management rules promulgated by the superintendent under authority of the West Virginia Code. It's not ambiguous.
Why did he make that argument, though?
I wish I knew. Perhaps he's a nut. This reminds me of the Nebraska case where the man moved to Nebraska from Colorado. And you remember the person he moved there and he had been convicted of an offense in Colorado as a juvenile. And he said that since Nebraska didn't register adjudicated juveniles, that his juvenile adjudication in Colorado shouldn't require him to register. And that's not what the law said of Nebraska. It said any person who had an obligation to register in another state had to register there upon moving there. So the court asked him, well, you are a person, right? So you remember that one?
I do remember you're a person.
You did move here. But the state argued because McGill was residing in West Virginia and been convicted of one of the qualifying offenses contained in West Virginia Code, he was required to register in West Virginia. And finally, the state asserted that the rule of lenity did not apply because the statute McGill's argument relied upon is not ambiguous. And it is not, in my opinion.
So then the circuit court granted McGill's motion to dismiss the order entered in on March 24th of 2023. It agreed with McGill's argument that West Virginia Code's the same things that I've been saying, 15-12-9C, was the only relevant statute under the facts of this case and determined that under this statute, the registration of out-of-state PFRs is applicable to any person presently required to register as a PFR in any other state. Applying this statutory interpretation to the facts of the current case, it is clear Respondent McGill discharged his duty to register in Ohio prior to moving to West Virginia. If it's so obvious, why did the circuit court grant the motion?
I wish I knew.
You're no help. All right, I'd like to review the legal standard or criteria to get a writ of prohibition. The court stated, in determining whether to entertain and issue the writ of prohibition, this court will examine five factors, and I'm going to go over those now, so hang on to your hats. whether the party seeking the writ has no other adequate means, such as direct appeal, to obtain the desired relief. Number two, whether the petitioner will be damaged or prejudiced in any way that is not correctable on appeal. Three, whether the lower tribunal's order is clearly erroneous as a matter of law. Four, whether the lower tribunal's order is an oft-repeated error and or manifest persisted disregard for either procedural or substantive law. And finally, number five, whether the lower tribunal's order raises new and important problems or issues of law of first impression. Now, this sounds similar to me to the Kennedy-Mendoza-Martinez factors for determining if registration is punitive. Which of the fives was relevant in this case?
Well, the court stated in the opinion, these factors are general guidelines that serve as a useful starting point for determining whether discretion or writ of prohibition should issue. Although all five factors need not be satisfied, it is clear that the third factor, the existence of clear error as a matter of law, should be given substantial weight. This case was easily decided by the third factor. It was clearly erroneous.
Now, what is the circuit court's role in reviewing an indictment?
Very limited in West Virginia. According to the court, generally speaking, the finding by a grand jury that the evidence is sufficient is not subject to judicial review. A court may review an indictment only for constitutional error and procedural misconduct. Thus, the court has held that except for willful, intentional fraud, the law of the state does not permit the court to go beyond an indictment to inquire that the evidence considered by the grand jury either determine its legality or sufficiency. So basically, what they have said in West Virginia is when we convene a panel of citizens and ask them to review this for probable cause, we do not second guess them.
Then on page 10, Larry, the court stated, in the instant case, the circuit court did not dismiss the indictment based on prosecutorial misconduct or constitutional sufficiency, and McGowan did not raise either of those issues. Instead, the circuit court's ruling was based on its conclusion that a factual basis for the indictment did not exist. That is, the circuit court found that because McGowan was no longer required to register in Ohio, he was not required to register as a PFR in West Virginia pursuant to the circuit court's interpretation of West Virginia code, those things that I said. This is wrong, Larry. You have to admit that, or else I'm pressing the buttons to turn it off right now. Admit it.
No, I can't admit that. As the court stated, this ruling clearly violated our prior case law, including syllabus point 3 of Gwaltney, and impermissibly invaded the grand jury's province. The grand jury found probable cause for McGowan to stand trial on two counts of a second or subsequent failure to register or provide notice of registration changes. The circuit court erroneously second-guessed this finding based on its conclusion that the facts of this case did not support the two counts contained in the indictment. In sum, the circuit court lacked the authority to dismiss based on its conclusion that the indictment lacked a sufficient factual basis.
Well, Mr. Doom and Gloom, for sure, you're hopeless. So what's next for Mr. McGowan?
Well, he now gets to stand trial, and that's where this case becomes more interesting.
Why is that?
Well, because he probably would have been able to plead it down to a failure to register first rather than a failure to register second. But for all this litigation that he chose to undertake, now that they've won, they have no reason to negotiate a favorable plea. Now, can you finally admit that that's funny?
Nope, not in my DNA, Larry. It's not funny at all. So what is the difference between a first and second in terms of the penalty for failure to comply?
Well, that's where it gets funny. West Virginia.
Of course.
Code 15-12-8C provides any person required to register for life pursuant to this article who knowingly provides materially false information or who refuses to provide accurate information when so required by the terms of the article or who knowingly fails to register, which is what he did, or knowingly fails to provide a change in required information as required by this article, is guilty of a felony and upon conviction thereof shall be imprisoned in a state correctional facility for not less than 1 year nor more than 5 years. Now, that's for the first time. So he gets a year. And I remember here we can get probation here and up to 18 months. any person convicted for a second offense under this subsection is guilty of a felony, and upon conviction, therefore, shall be imprisoned at a correctional facility for not less than 10 or not more than 25. That's a significant difference between the one-year minimum and a 10-year minimum. So there is the difference. And if I'm the state, I'm not that vindictive, but if you've put me through all this work and I've won, why would I make a great deal for you?
I see your logic there. I'm still, Larry, I need to go back to some of the things that we've said, that the way that the statute reads for West Virginia, that it's not you've been convicted of, it's if you were required to register. And if he was discharged from Ohio, why would he have to register in West Virginia? I missed something. I don't understand.
Because that is merely one part of the registry, and people like to pick and choose the parts of the statute that they read. That is not the only duty that triggers. That is the duty that triggers to make sure you don't fall through the cracks, to make sure that they scoop everybody up. So they have the first analysis is whether the conviction is substantially similar to one on their list, and if the process that secured that conviction met the minimum due process requirements that's outlined. And some countries don't have minimum due process, so the conviction wouldn't be covered. But this occurred within an American state of Ohio that would meet the due process requirements. So he has an equivalent offense. That is merely designed to enhance the reach of the registry. It's not as a reciprocity move. And people look at that, they say, well, it says if I have to register in Georgia, when I move to Georgia, it says I have to register in Alabama, I have to register here. But that's only one part of the test. Only one part of the test. And you have to read the statute in harmony with all sections combined. And that's what this brilliant guy didn't do. I don't know what he does for a living, but you've got to read the statutory scheme and harmonize all sections of it.
And I'm assuming no one talked to you first?
No, he didn't ring my phone off the hook. But I suspect he's not going to be moving around very much for the next 10 years or so.
Doesn't seem like it. And so if he were able to plead it down to the first time offense, he would have a 1 year time locked up, and now he's facing 10 or more?
He's facing 10 to 25. And I don't know if I would seek to 25, but if I'm the prosecution, I am not going to let him plead this down to a first, because you made me do work. I didn't have to do all this work.
Isn't that just vindictive? And, I'll just say it. It's a dick move.
It is, but that's the reality of human nature. If you make someone do a whole bunch of work, why would they be sweet to you? The reason why you make plea bargains is because you don't want to do work.
Anything else?
Yeah, I think we've got that covered, and you did not admit any of it was funny.
Are you surprised?
Not really. I think after 7 years, it's not going to happen.
Are you a first-time listener of Registry Matters? Well, then make us a part of your daily routine and subscribe today. Just search for Registry Matters through your favorite podcast app. Hit the subscribe button and you're off to the races. You can now enjoy hours of sarcasm and snark from Andy and Larry on a weekly basis. Oh, and there's some excellent information thrown in there too. Subscribing also encourages others of you people to get on the bandwagon and become regular Registry Matters listeners. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to Registry Matters right now. Help us keep fighting and continue to say FYP.
Well, so this is going to be the article that we teased our last go-around from filtermag.org. Enough with the PFR registry is the title of the article, and as it shows up on the display there, it's the picture that I showed last time with the officers going up the stairs to go knock on someone's door. And so we have this article that's probably another left-wing radical bunch of nuts there from that magazine. And law enforcement has done a good job of portraying recidivism as a kind of unfortunate tendency. Some people just can't get help. Rarely do media and pop culture indicate that a parole violation can mean that the state equivalent of the FBI taking you into custody without warning because you are using an adult webcam site while inside your own home. Christy paroled out of Georgia Department of Corrections custody in September of 2023 after about 13 years of incarceration stemming from survival sex work. Being forced to register comes with an onslaught of fees, often hundreds of dollars per month, that are mandatory to pay as a condition of parole. While at the same time, the registry disqualifies people from almost every job that isn't remote or very rural, which makes live streaming on an adult webcam site a logical option. That makes sense so far, Larry, until take it away.
Well, the article states that, quote, sex work is often one of the few sources of income, if not the only one, that people in the PFR register are able to access. Anything prohibited by law, such as prostitution, is an automatic parole violation for anyone on the PFR registry. But there's nothing illegal about live streaming by consenting adults. And that's what I've heard. I've heard consenting adults do this all the time. However, parole and probation and PFR registries go past the law to criminalize people for activity that is actually legal.
With less than 5 months left on parole, Christy is now in county jail, ostensibly because she's not allowed to look at prawn. The special conditions Georgia imposes on registrants who are also on parole are notorious for ambiguity. For example, could a condition that supervisees shall not use or consume any controlled substance or mind-altering drug, including alcohol, except pursuant to a legal doctor's prescription, be interpreted to allow low THC oil but prohibit nicotine? Can they do that, Larry?
Yes, they could, but no parole officer is likely to apply this to cigarettes, but it's not out of the question. It could be applied to vapes. But can you do me a favor? Can you read the special conditions that are commonly imposed in cases like Christie's? This comes directly from the article, so I'm assuming it's valid.
I'll take it. And I could almost recite the 23 that I had from memory. But all right, so here are the six that are listed. An individual under supervision shall not purchase or possess any prawn or sexually explicit material. Number two, an individual under supervision shall not frequent or be employed by any business exhibiting prawn materials or activities. Number three, individual will not visit, access prawn sites or chat rooms on the internet. Now, it says chat rooms. Do we have to apply the prawn word to chat rooms or just chat rooms, period? That's kind of vague, right?
That might be vague, yes. I'll concede that.
All right. Then number four, individual under supervision shall remain fully an appropriate... Wait, I'm sorry. Wait. How do you take a shower? Before I finish the rest of this. How do I finish the rest of the sentence? An individual under supervision shall remain fully and appropriately clothed and will not engage in lewd behavior when in public or when potential for public view exists. So make sure that your window is closed in your bathroom just in case, because you're in your house, assumed to be private, and oh my God, somebody saw you. You're now in parole violation. All right. Number five, the individual under supervision shall not associate with prostitutes, because that's what we all do on a regular basis, Larry, is we associate with prostitutes, and will avoid areas known to have prostitution activity. I don't have any idea where prostitution activity occurs. Me personally, I do not know. I don't know that I could find one. Lastly, the individual under supervision shall work only at places pre-approved by his or her community supervision officer. Holy moly. This is insane. This is sick. The article raises many questions. Is live streaming from inside your home, quote-unquote, public view? Is a third-party platform a business and is using one to live stream a job? Are you allowed to have nudes of your own body on your own phone? What prevents any area from being known to have prostitution activity? Like, there could be a prostitute at the mall, and you go to the mall. Sorry, there's prostitution activity in the mall. Sorry, you're violated. And this is all just based on if a parole officer decides it. And ultimately, is legal sex work clearly prohibited?
Well, these things are probably unlawful and unconstitutional, but it's only when a court decides these things are unlawful until the court rules that they're not. So, you got to start electing people that put different kind of judges on the bench. But that's another political conversation. But this is the way it is.
Oh, you're going to bring up elections again, huh?
Not over my dead body. I'm not bringing up elections.
The condition directly applicable to this situation is the ban on accessing prawn sites or chat rooms on the internet. But here, there's an argument to be made about intent, which the Georgia State Board of Pardons and Parole has indicated does matter. Per one of the other conditions, supervisees may not attend any place, business, amusement, social event, or gathering of any type for the purpose of coming into contact with minors. In other words, the board acknowledges that it's possible that someone on the registry might go somewhere in public for some reason other than preying on children and doesn't seek to restrict that. If someone visits an online version of these places, like a chat room, for a purpose that is clearly not coming into contact with minors, like visiting a chat room for people 18 and up, wouldn't the approach to those situations be consistent?
I wish it were that way, but it is not.
Can they not understand that live streaming adult content potentially allows someone to keep up with their registry fees without going into public places? Through legal work in a space that does not allow minors and does not serve alcohol. Like, this sounds perfect. Few options seem better suited to the board's conditions, and the registry continues to grow. It's reasonable to assume that more people will access adult websites with the specific intent of remaining in compliance with conditions that the board imposes and simultaneously takes away the means to fulfill.
But as the article stated, quote, it's unclear what the public safety benefit of revoking parole would be in these cases. The board, of course, did not respond to Filter Magazine's request for comment. Remember that Georgia is under conservative control, and they pride themselves on being fiscally responsible. It's so unfortunate that elected officials are not called out for this hypocrisy. Now, folks, I just did it. Mimic what I just did. This is your team. Do what I just did. Ask those questions to the people that profess their fiscal responsibility. Do what I did. It doesn't hurt that bad. Try it.
The article states, in our judicial system, we don't apply blanket restrictions to particular groups, but almost nothing about PFR registries is individualized. That is for literally for damn sure. The federal PFR, SORNA, uses a tier system for classifying registrants based on their conviction. States are incentivized to model their own system after SORNA, but most, including Georgia, do not. While Christie's conviction would let her off the registry after 15 years under federal SORNA, in Georgia, it's a lifelong requirement for everyone.
Again, I can't help myself. Remember that Georgia professes to believe in keeping government small and not wasting public resources. According to this article, as of August, there were 38,339 people registered as PFRs in Georgia, a more than a 50% increase over the last decade.
I can tell you firsthand that from when I started tracking this, there were 25-ish, you know, in a decade ago. So that's totally consistent with that.
But again, I don't get any pushback from the conservatives who elect these people who profess that they believe in small government. Ask them why they do these things. Ask them why they require a longer period of registration than the federal government recommends. That tough federal SORNA requires shorter periods of registration. Ask them pointedly, if you are as conservative and fiscally as responsible as you claim to be, why are we doing these things? Please do this. I do it all the time.
So then the article states, though, the state refers to registry classification in a way that invites the public to believe everyone gets evaluated and classified as level 1 or level 2 or ASDP. About 2/3 of registrants, including Christie, are never assigned a level. This indicates that they aren't considered a risk by the volunteer members of the Sex Offender Registration Review Board, but also that they just aren't considered. Everyone, regardless of conviction or mitigating circumstances, is painted into the same broad brush, which is how the state justifies monitoring everyone's internet access if they are equally motivated to distribute CP.
As if they were equally motivated, and they're not. I don't know what the percentage is, but it's only a fraction of the people that are on the PFR registry that have distributed that. A whole lot of other things put you on that list other than that. But the article states, in our judicial system, we don't apply blanket restrictions to particular groups. I think you already read that. But this is particularly egregious considering these registries are dragnets for a variety of groups already targeted for violence, including transgender women, people who engage in sex work, people who use drugs, and people living with HIV. This liberal left-leaning rag certainly understands the issue very well.
So it would seem. The story also then states, after a year of scrambling for any work she was allowed to accept, Christie had just gotten a promising job interview with a nonprofit and missed it because she was in county jail. She was recently appointed to the advisory board of a university pilot program exploring health care during reentry and will miss the inaugural meeting if she's still in county jail or in prison. Next, she'll miss a panel where she's due to speak on incarceration and the clergy, then her keynote speech at a trans healthcare symposium, then her first Christmas with her husband. Well, all right, so she's going to miss all of those first kind of things. This is so very wrong.
Well, then you need to ask the voters of Georgia to explain it, because I can't. And I hope you have the picture of the stairwell being loaded with people when they're knocking on the doors, they're doing their probation parole checks.
Now, this is up on the screen now.
This is the conservative people who believe in keeping government nice and small and compact.
Absolutely.
And they're putting such vast amount of resources into this. Please call them out on that. Ask them why, because they're not of my cloth. I don't know what to do with them, but this is what the people of Georgia apparently want to spend their money on. And they don't mind her being in county jail at whatever expense. They don't mind her being in prison at whatever expense, but they don't want her making any money so that she can be a productive citizen and pay a little tax. I mean, can you at least admit that that's funny?
It's definitely not funny. It's really pathetic. They've put, quote unquote, our people inside this tiny little box. And here's this tiny little pinhole of a window where you're essentially in compliance of all of them, except for this really, puritanical view of, oh my God, now you're promoting sex, and we can't have that happen. So we're going to be in violation of your rules.
So I don't have an explanation. I just know that there needs to be more public pressure applied to elected officials. You need to call them out with consistent factual examples of where waste is occurring and how you would like to have that waste addressed. And you need to tell them that your vote going forward may be contingent upon them showing more interest in not being so wasteful with resources. And they listen to that. Trust me, they listen to that.
Oh, yeah. What else down here do you want to cover real quick? We're only at 40 minutes.
I'm not really prepared for anything. What's wrong with a short episode?
Nothing is wrong with it at all. So with that, I will tell everyone how to reach us. And so head over to registrymatters.co to find the show notes, download the podcast, which is where, like, I mean, this is a podcast. We get a lot of views on YouTube, but it is a podcast. And you could download it and listen to it at your leisure. And it's really easy to, like, speed it up. And then I can, not only do I talk fast, Larry, you should hear me on 1.5.
So you did submit something to me this morning that I didn't understand, so it might be helpful if I just take a minute. That message you forwarded me from the guy,
I'm drawing a blank on what I sent you.
It says,
"Oh, I know what I sent you. It's from one of our patrons."
Yes, he said, "I can show papers that after probation of 15 years on state charge and civil scheme, have 15 years of community supervision in Rhode Island, and the parole officer has me 13 things beyond registration." But see, I'm confused, because if you're on community supervision, they can impose conditions on you. He says, "I register once a year, level one, and already got probation done 15 years, and there's another 15 years of parole. And I still use travel papers for work every 30 days, but you're under supervision, even though it's not, it may have a different name, but you're reporting to an officer. It's not a part of the same." So if he can clarify what he means by that comment, that would be helpful. I can answer it more thoroughly next episode.
John, write in with more information. Instead of, maybe, I don't know. I don't know if Patreon limits. He always sends messages over Patreon. If you need to send something longer, or even record a voice memo, and you could either email it. Yeah, email it. But doing that would help explain this out a little better. So that's John. He's a pretty recent patron, but he comments every week on our episodes.
Well, when people are on supervision, a lot of people have complaints because they've added supervision that they weren't aware of, apparently, at the time they did their plea. You know, like, they have community supervision for life in some states like New Jersey and Tennessee and whatnot. And although it's not formal probation that they were told at the time they were sentenced, apparently it's been woven in to their requirements. But if you're under supervision, your travel is very much restricted. When you're just simply registering, you can travel anywhere you want to. Period. You don't need papers to travel. And I take that back. In Alabama, you have to notify them, but you don't need permission. You just have to give them notice that you're traveling out of state. And you still are allowed to travel as a PFR under non-supervision status, but you have to notify them that you're traveling.
Do you want to cover anything else?
No, I'm happy to have a short episode. It'll make it easier for our transcriptionist, and then I can be meaner to him when he doesn't do a good job.
Joey, that's you, buddy. All right. Okay. So anyway, registrymatters.co, find the show notes. Leave voicemail. That goes for you, John. Send us a voice memo of your question at 747-227-4477. Email registrymatterscast@gmail.com. And please, if you'd be so kind, head over to patreon.com/registrymatters. And for as little as $1 a month, you can show your appreciation for the show. And it helps us fill the coffers. No, I'm just kidding. Just shows us some support and kind of offsets a little burden of the time. Because I don't know, Larry, how many hours do you put into this thing every week?
It's more than I can count. It's usually at least about a half a day on Saturday or more in prep. And then all the week long, I'm looking for content and trying to analyze it. So it's not just we connect and do the talking. A lot of work goes into it, pre and post. You do more of the post than I do. The only part of the post I do is the transcript and distribution. But a lot of work goes into this, and we do pay the transcriptionist a little bit of money.
$1.50 an hour?
A little bit better than that.
Thank you all very much for coming and hanging out. It's early still, so I'll hang out for a while. Maybe I can convince Larry to hang out for a while as well.
I hang out for a few minutes if people have questions, but I have a hot date.
Hot date? All right. Well, then, so hang out, everyone, and we'll see what we can do. And I'll talk to you all soon.
You've been listening to FYP.